This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Ridiculously large families, conjoined twins, arthroscopic surgery. What do they have in common? They are the subject matter for many of Bill Hayes' television programs and documentaries. Programs like this.
John and I both always knew we wanted to have kids.
Hi.
But never imagined we'd have this many.
We weren't able to get pregnant on our own, so we turned to fertility treatments.
And we were thrilled when we had our twin girls, Kara and Maddie.
Then, when we decided to have just one more, we got a little more than we bargained for. We got six more.
That's John and Kate plus eight, one of the shows that Bill is responsible for in one way or another. Others include 19 Kids and Counting and Sister Wives. Bill grew up on a chicken, tobacco, and dairy farm in Mount Airy, North Carolina. Worked 14-hour days as a teenager, knew fairly early on that he did not want to pursue a career in farming, but wasn't quite sure what he did want to do. Went to Duke University, studied economics and psychology, worked as a bartender, a management consultant, and assistant press secretary for Senator John Ingram, and then decided he wanted to make some documentaries. Friends and colleagues laughed at Bill's decision to start his own production company in Chapel Hill. His response, why not? And he proved the naysayers wrong, found success as the founder of Figure Eight Films. And Bill Hayes is my guest today on The State of Things. Welcome. So good to have you here.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
So you grew up in the real Mayberry.
I did. My granddad had a hardware store on Main Street, which my dad took over. And then my mom took that over. When I was just a little boy, we moved out into the country, lived on a farm.
What was that like? You had to do chores, as they say on the farm?
Well, I have four sisters, and just me. And my dad, I like to say, is like right off the set of Lonesome Dove. Never met an animal he wouldn't shoot, kill, and eat. He's 88, still drives around in his pickup with a little high-powered rifle. So it was real.
Wow, yeah. Did you work on the farm? I mean, you did a lot of that stuff?
This is the 1960s. You don't have a choice. I used to kid that I was an indentured slave.
Yeah.
Jokingly, I didn't know any better. We loved it. My uncles all had farms, tobacco farms or chicken farms, and if we weren't working on our farm, we were working on one of our relatives' farms.
So, and also came from a family of entrepreneurs, right?
Well, my mom's mom had a little grocery store in between, Grandma Dockery, in between Dobson and Elkin and Zephyr. And her husband was a tobacco farmer, and my granddad was a businessman, and dad had his own business, and mom ran her own business. So when people used to say entrepreneur, I just used to laugh and think, that's just a fancy word. We just run our own companies.
Well, so did that mean, because if you have your own company, you might not have to clear land, grow tobacco, and feed chickens.
There's always heavy lifting.
Yeah.
Basically I was still the guy taking out the garbage while trying to cut a contract with a network. So
doing that hard work. So you're working hard. You've got a family full of business people and hunters and farmers and then kind of reality stories growing up right under your roof. Two sisters, both of whom eloped, eh?
My oldest sister, Donna, who's a brilliant painter and has her own 5-acre vineyard, some of the best grapes in North Carolina, Cabernet, Tannat, Sangiovese blend, overlooking a lake, looking over Fisher's Peak in the mountain. We had moved all seven of us into a three-room house, three rooms, not three bedrooms. My oldest sister was a chief cheerleader, senior in high school, National Honor Society, quickly decided that she couldn't handle it. And on April Fool's Day, her birthday, she eloped. My next sister eloped 2 weeks later and went on to become a head of a lab and run labs all over the country. But yeah, it was, the funny thing was we lived in this little teeny house and everybody wanted to come visit. It was miles of dirt roads, lots of snakes, rattlesnakes, copperheads, water moccasins, everything. It wasn't safe. You wouldn't think it's safe. Today's world safe. In those days, we didn't know any better. We were riding horses and ponies around, but you worked all the time, but it was fun. It was for yourself.
Well, where were these people coming from who wanted to visit you? They wanted to see the country life?
All my grade school buddies. I went to school in town at Franklin Elementary in Mount Airy, in Toast, actually the suburb of Mount Airy. So people loved to get it. When I went to Duke and I would tell people, I went to school in Toast, they always got a big kick out of that.
There is a Toast, North Carolina?
There is a Toast, North Carolina.
Endlessly fascinating. So there's Toast, and then there's Bun.
Oh, absolutely.
Wow, this could be a series
for you.
Absolutely. Careful.
Well, do you think about that? I mean, we're going to get into some of the details of the series that you've been a part of, but, I mean, nine people growing up in a three-room house in the farm, you know, in the shadow of Andy?
Well, seven of us.
Seven total?
Seven with visitors constantly. No, I don't think about it. You know, what I think about is that in my grandma's grocery store, the farmers were always telling stories. And my granddad's mom's hardware store, people were always telling stories. So I grew up listening to people tell stories all the time. And so to grow up and tell stories for a living, only I do it with lots of people helping me and lots of tools. It's not so dissimilar.
When you were living there, was that your goal? I mean, were you ever going to be a farmer?
No, I was going to be a baseball player, but I couldn't hit a curveball. So I had two ways to get out of farm work, sports and school. So I played every sport, football, basketball, baseball, track, and eventually got a letter in lacrosse in college. And I made really good grades, so I got a full ride to go to Duke. I'm married to a woman who actually is an advisor to the Moorhead Scholars, and I liked a kid that I didn't get the Moorhead because I wore too much polyester to my interview. It was the 70s.
Yeah, what was wrong with that?
Maybe it was the platform shoes.
It could have been that. So you went to Duke, studied. What did you major in?
Well, I majored in having a good time. I was a slave off the farm, but I eventually settled down and studied psychology and economics. But they didn't have a— Today's Duke is a very different place. Now they've got a certificate in film and video. They got the Center for Documentary Studies. I'd have probably either been majoring in public policy with a minor in film and video, and you know, spending my time at the Center for Documentary Studies and Tom Rankin's group.
So you can get an MFA right now in that subject, which is kind of cool. But were you interested in that kind of thing, making documentaries?
No, you know, what happened was this. I got out of school, didn't have any work experience in the other world other than on the farm. Knew how to work hard, but didn't have a resume. And so I did some soul searching. I was in Atlanta, moved to Atlanta, the biggest city around, moved in with a kid I knew from Carolina, and then got a job doing retail sales and the very first video retail company in America, and learned how to sell some things. Meanwhile, I was a bartender, did three or four jobs, and then I started doing some soul searching. I thought, you know, one of these days I'd like to be a teacher, but they don't make enough money. So maybe I could make documentaries. Wouldn't that be cool? I could meet interesting people, travel the world, learn a few things. And so I sort of set that aside and thought, you know, one day that's what I want to do. And then I sort of set about getting some experience for myself. So I was fortunate enough to get a couple of different jobs as a management consultant, learning how to run businesses. And then I eventually became a marketing director for a computer hardware company and then a VP of sales for a computer software company. And in my late 20s, finally, one of my buds from Duke needed a video for Crabtree Valley Mall. And for like this gigantic sum of $10,000, I was the producer, director, writer, and it worked. I was like, darn, this is great. I can do this.
When was this a sort of a commercial, a promotional video?
Yeah, it was just a little piece for their grand reopening of Crabtree Valley Mall. So then I took that to this guy in Durham, Bob Chapman, who had a company called Learning Resources, who was doing college videos but had an eye on doing something greater. And I said, you know, here, I can do this. Let me do this. And he said, well, go sell something. So I said, okay. So I went out and I sold a video to a real estate company. And then I sold another video to a real estate company. And then Glaxo had just come here and they put out for bid an interactive video to teach their sales representatives about hypertension and the cardiovascular system. And they had some money. It was $250,000 project, which was 25 years ago. It was big money. Oh, yeah. It's still money. But so
in public radio dollars, that's still pretty big.
Yeah, well, there you go. It's like less an hour television or less than. But anyway, so we did it. I sold this thing, and it worked. And by default, I became the producer.
But that's interesting because that means that you have to learn about – I mean, that is – storytelling, I'm sure, is going to be part of it. But you're going to have to learn about hypertension. You're going to have to learn about, you know, all of the details that you're going to teach and
which is great fun. I mean, it goes back to what I originally wanted to do was just – you know, I was a nerdy jock as a kid. I was one of those kids who hid under the covers with the flashlight at night so I could read books. And my parents, you know, come fuss at me for reading. Put the book down at the table. You know, I was one of those kids. I loved to read. And, you know, and I still love to learn. So I thought, you know, this is a great job to have because it requires that you're constantly learning something about some other topic, subject, people.
And then communicate it to people who may have some vague knowledge of that, but actually communicate what you know in a way that they can take it, if they're salespeople, and go communicate it to others. That's a couple of other steps in there.
It is, but the great thing about my life and business is I don't do it by myself. I have comrades more talented than me. So I, you know, at this point in my evolution, I'm just the guy who gets things started a lot of times, but, you know, it's so much fun to be with a team of people because, that, as you well know, collaboration is one of the greatest things ever.
Yeah. Well, we'll find out about that team and some of the things you got started when my conversation with Bill Hayes continues. His company, Figure Eight Films, created television hits like John and Kate Plus Eight, Sister Wives, and we'll find out more about all of that when our conversation continues on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, and today we're talking with the founder of Figure Eight Films and the producer of programs like John and Kate Plus Eight, 19 Kids and Counting. Bill Hayes is with us. You talked about the number of jobs you had, including working as John Ingram's assistant press secretary when he was running against Jesse Helms, right? Tell us about your political life.
That was disillusioning.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I feel like politics is a lot of smoke and mirrors. I even followed Harvey Gantt and Jesse Helms around and never finished that project. And, you know, I felt it was disappointing. I feel like there was a lot of bad communication, and I think we, the public and the media, should hold our feet to the fire and be more accountable of what we let transpire. But we're not being served properly, and that's, if we don't change that, we're going to continue a slide downward.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that, because then there's this gulf between perception, what we perceive. Obviously, there are people who are manipulating messages. Their job is to get the candidate elected. They're trying to get into the psyche of the public. The public is trying to critically evaluate, but if all the information they're getting is coming through these filters, how do you see your way clear?
I don't know. That's, you know, when I get into political discussions with people, I usually preface it by saying, look, we're all forming our opinions on what I consider a lot of faulty information. Yeah. So where do we go with that? You know, I feel like we've got to turn around that somehow or another, and I don't have the answers for that. That's, which could lead you to what we do, which is trying to be authentic in the process of telling stories.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that. Maybe that's our insight. Talk about programs that we call reality shows. You talked about Crabtree Mall, and then you do this thing for Glaxo, trying to train their salespeople. And eventually you started doing medical kind of videos,
well,
right?
For me that was just pure information, and medical stories were great platform for storytelling because there's a good guy and a bad guy, the illness, the disease, that's your bad guy. The good guys were the patients, the healthcare providers, their families. There's a beginning, middle, and end to a surgical procedure. So we created these interactive videos, and then I was fortunate enough to work with Dr. Gary Paling up at the Bowman Gray School of Medicine to create a video journal of our interactive video on wrist arthroscopy, then a video journal, which was the very first video supplement to a medical journal in medicine. And I thought, well, this is great storytelling. So I had this experience with these doctors. One day I saw this operation on television on the Learning Channel. I called them up and said, hey, I can do that better than that. And they said, you should come talk to this guy, Mike Quattroni. He's thinking about commissioning. I said, what's commissioning? Next thing I knew, I had a gig making television shows. But it was, you know, it was real drama. People were going behind the curtain that we couldn't normally see with our eyes open. And my job was to have the surgeons talk in plain English, which is what they weren't terribly skilled at doing. So felt like we were providing a hugely valuable service. And I had countless people come up to me and say, I saw that show. That was really, it helped me. It helped my family. We were going through that. So that's how we really got into the television production business in the first place.
And that aired, was that the Learning Channel?
1992, yeah. The Learning Channel. And we did 6 years of that. And then we had to try to figure out a way for us to get out of us people thinking of as somebody that only made shows about surgical television. So I landed this series called Breed All About It for the Animal Planet. And at those days, we were advanced medical education, became advanced medical productions, became Figure Eight Films, because I was initially just a medical production company. And then we thought, you know, we should broaden our horizons, and we did.
Well, let's talk about those medical programs, too, because the program was called The Operation, right?
Yes.
That was it. And we've got a clip from that. We can talk a little bit more about it. Let's listen.
I'm required by law to check with you as to whether you have an advance directive. That's like a living will or a power of attorney for health.
The aneurysm, despite the best efforts of Mr. Dirksen and his cardiologists, have expanded to the point where the rupture of the aneurysm is a real possibility. The rupture of the aneurysm, as we mentioned before, will certainly kill him, 100% probability. When is that going to happen? Because I would like to operate on Mr. Dirksen one day before that happens, so I would not have to risk his life and potentially shorten his life any sooner than I have to.
And there's a clip from the television show The Operation, ran in the 90s, produced and created by my guest, Bill Hayes. And again, there the whole idea is really is kind of patient education, right? This is where...
Somewhat, but it was still entertaining, it might have been educational, but it was grossly engaging,
right,
is what the word we started with instead of entertaining. That was the very first show we ever did, and that... It reminds me about what we continue to do, which is, I'd say, tell stories from the inside out instead of the outside in. So we feel like our job is to help our subjects tell their own stories in their words. And if you'll notice, we were sort of on the forefront of this trend of not using narrators and having, which is takes a lot of skill and you might say manipulation, but certainly some coaching to get your subjects to share their story in the way that it can be consumed by the viewers.
Well, I mean, that's the key to this, is you can't just get on there and say, oh, let people tell their own stories. You try that, you're going to fail, because it's one thing to be therapeutic and listen deeply, and that helps somebody if they just talk and talk and talk. Now, if you want anybody else to listen to that, you have to curate the story, you have to coach. How much of that goes on? Do you say, no, say it this way? Do you put words in their mouth, or you just say, let's try it again, take three, take nine, take 30?
It varies highly. It depends on who you're working with. Some people are natural-born storytellers. Some people struggle at it. It doesn't mean that their story is not interesting. It's just, do they have the ability to share that story? So, and you never truly know until you get into the heat of the situation with people whether it's going to work or not. I mean, that's the beauty. One of the great things about making documentaries or television is you always have these preconceived notions about what the story is going to be, and then when you get out there, it's typically much better than you ever imagined. But it's not what you had thought it was going to be, so you have to adjust. You have to be quick on your feet and adjust accordingly.
What's the value in it? I mean, if there's a message that you want to get through, you need to talk about the hard decisions that are going to have to be made. So think about this, folks, in advance. I think that's one of the lessons we could draw from that episode. Why can't I script it? What's the difference between that authentic story and whatever you could script?
When you hear his voice, there's a texture and a tone to Dr. Gaudiani's voice. We called him the Italian Stallion. That, you know, I can't have some... When you try to read something, if I were to sit here and read this, my script for you, it wouldn't sound the same. Well, our ears are more sophisticated, our brains. We pick up that. It's like listening to music, like a note of music. If we're trying to, you know, if you're sitting there just trying as opposed to it coming forth from inside your soul, very different type of music that you're listening to. Same thing with anybody trying to tell their story. When they start to tell their story, it's called passion. It's called feeling. And that comes forth when people are natural, not when they're trying to be told what to do.
But you can hire actors, and that's their job. And if they're any good, that's how they're successful on stage.
And people make millions of dollars doing that. But what happened with television is the television programmers were looking for a more cost-effective way to put entertainment out to people. And they realized with this, what we now call reality, I don't really like that word. I would rather, you know, we could talk about that. But it's... You know, but they realized, boy, this is a cost-effective way to get some storytelling and get some product on the air, because with as many channels as we have, inventory is an issue for them. They need programming.
So what's your objection to that term, reality?
Well, I think that it dilutes what we're trying to do in terms, you know, it's gotten a bad connotation. It's gotten so overused that people think of it as very negative. They think of it as manipulation. They think of it as not being truthful. They think of it as not being square up or the real story. So our brand, the Figure Eight Film brand, has been one that's known as being more authentic, trying to capture people's stories in as pure a form. Now, sure, we help create situations or put them in situations that they may not normally do on their own, but then we let them be themselves. The Duggars, we just went with our 19 kids and counting family to China and Japan. But, you know, once we're there, they're themselves. You know, we may put them in situations, but you're still seeing who they really are. We're not asking them to be somebody they're not.
But you're putting them in a situation with TV cameras all around them and a TV contract. So that who they are is something different than who they would have been if they hadn't shown up.
Yes, and but say somebody like the Duggars, we have such a family approach to our business that the people that work with me are super nice people and bright. And when they go out and interact with our subjects, they become like their family. And after a while, our subjects say, you know, we would miss them if they weren't here, and they forget about them. So I used to call it, when we were in the medical business, being the sterile fly on the wall. And now what we try to do is, again, you know, that's the beauty of documentaries. You're supposed to not be part of the story. You're supposed to be more innocuous. So we still have that mindset in the back of our head of how do we just fit in and let people be themselves.
Tell us how John and Kate came along.
My business partner, I have two partners, Kirk Streb and Deanie Wilcher. Kirk's the creative one and Deanie's the financial one. But Deanie, the network said, why don't you go find us a family of multiples? So my business partner, Deanie, found them online. And I called them up and said, hey, let's do an hour documentary. And they said, sure. And then we did another one. And then the network said, this is really getting some viewers. Why don't we take this thing to series? So a woman named Jen Stocks, who we brought in from Los Angeles to work for us, whose dad was a doctor in Raleigh, she and Kirk pretty much came up with the structure for telling that story in what I call a 22-minute four-act play. And, you know, again, which was novel. Nobody had set people down on the couch. It was sort of like a Harry Met Sally. We put them on the couch. We have them talk to us. But we came up with some structure for telling their stories outside of a documentary.
And we should point out, John and Kate plus eight, a married couple. They couldn't have children. She's taking fertility drugs. They end up with eight kids.
No, well, they end up with twins and then sextuplets.
Yeah. So now, and that's their story. And your job at first was just to find a family with multiple.
Well, and because the two things that made that story so successful, there's lots of things that made it successful, but when people ask me over and over again, why? And I say, well, because they were relatable yet extraordinary at the same time. Mm-hmm. They were pretty regular folks, yet through the luck of the fertility draw, they ended up with all these kids. So the women would go, oh my God, but for the grace of God, that could be me. Mm. Or the husband might be going, oh, at least he doesn't treat me that bad, you know, but people could relate to him.
And you said it started as a documentary, then a second, then it becomes a series. Structurally, is that different? Conceptually, do you come at it differently once it becomes a series, and how so?
Yeah, absolutely. It's just documentaries have different structures to them in terms of the informational nature of a documentary is very different than the entertaining nature of an ongoing series, docu-series, reality series, whatever you want to call it. So you're going to run out of storylines pretty quickly if you don't figure out different things. I mean, we did like 150 episodes of John and Kate. That's a lot of story.
And each one of those needs its own beginning, middle, end, right?
Correct. Correct. And as Sister Wives is our current hit, and you've got to have what we call stickiness from episode to episode. So in the old days of cable, people were just channel surfing. There wasn't what we call destination viewing. Now there is. Now there's destination viewing. So people tune in to watch Sister Wives because they want to, not just because they happen by it.
So what's the stickiness factor? What makes it sticky?
Well, different things for different shows. With Sister Wives, you can't believe this one guy is married to four wives, and you're wondering if that's just going to work out. Same thing with Kate. You're wondering, how is she going to do it with these eight kids? When is it going to all come? Or the same thing with the Duggars. How can they do it with 19 kids? Are you kidding me? How can... And they are as nice as they seem. Viewers are like, no, that can't be. She can't be that nice. But she is.
So it seems to me part of this is some extraordinary foundation, 19 kids, multiple wives, that sort of thing, and then ordinary enough situations so that I can at least relate to it. They're not from Remulac.
Well, yeah, or not even our show. Say, take Duck Dynasties, the most popular show right now going on cable, or The Deadliest Catch. You know, these are, again, people that you can relate to, yet what they're doing is crazy or extraordinary, or certainly just you go, my goodness, why didn't I think of that? Or, man, those people are nuts.
You know, the photographer Deanne Arbus traded in this kind of thing as well, and she was sometimes criticized but often applauded for the work she would do with people who were considered outsized. So she did a lot of giants and dwarves and transvestites, transsexuals, people who were outside the mainstream, and she always argued that it was not a freak show of voyeurism for her, but in fact she was trying to show the normality and what it was they were trying to say about their lives that we couldn't see if we saw them as freaks.
We do the exact same thing. I mean, I've made more shows, my company's made more shows about conjoined twins than anybody in the world. And every time you get back to their humanity. They want to be loved, they need something to do, they want to have fun, family's important. We've done shows about people that weighed over 600 pounds, spiritual surgeons. One of my favorite stories ever was about armless Marty Ravalet, who people would see him in Chapel Hill. He would sit down at the end of the counter in Sutton's, eating breakfast with his feet, drinking his coffee with his feet, reading his USA Today with his feet. He was a Duke basketball fan right in the middle of Franklin Street. It was great. And he would drive me around town in his van with his feet while he was chain smoking. I used to say, Marty, I'm not worried about you wrecking. I am worried about you blowing us up. But his humanity was huge. I mean, and once you got to know him, he became one of my best friends. I mean, closest friends.
And your I guess, attraction to conjoined twins would not be an accident since perhaps the most famous pair in all America was right up there.
In history, the Siamese twins, because they were from Siam, right, with Ing and Chang. And oddly, I'd never thought about this growing up, but they married these two girls from Wilkes County and settled in White Plains, which is a suburb of Mount Airy, like Toast. And
the greater Mount Airy metroplex.
There's Flat Rock and there's Toast and there's a lot of Bannertown. But they ended up in Mount Airy as gentleman farmers in the 1800s. And they're a great story. And, you know, it's really fun.
And you found out that their family, their extended family, and they have quite a heritage.
Oh, my God. As I was telling you, one of their great-great-great-granddaughters, Alex Sink, who's Kester Sink's daughter, almost became the governor of Florida. I mean, it's just... it's stunning. Tanya Jones, who runs the Arts Council currently in Mount Airy, she's a descendant. I mean, they're everywhere.
Can you imagine the Andy Griffith Show as a reality show?
Oh, of course I can. That's a loaded question. I've been working on it. They wonder when you're going to ask me that.
Well, for one thing, Gomer could have come out on the show. Right?
Yeah,
I mean, you wouldn't have to wait until after.
Well, Thelma Lou actually does live in Mount Airy now. She came from Mayberry days and liked it so much she never left. But we're a sponsor of the Full Frame Film Festival, one of the many sponsors. And I'm sitting there a couple of years ago saying, I need to make a documentary again. This would be fun, other than just a commercial television show. So I thought, why not make one about my hometown of Mount Airy, the real Mayberry? And the idea is that my hometown, Mount Airy, is every bit as emblematic as the fictitious town was 50 years ago. We're a factory town that lost our tobacco factory town that lost our jobs, and now we're redefining ourselves in the 21st century. But when you go there, there's this Egyptian guy with an Italian restaurant on Main Street. My niece's husband's a crazy chiropractor who grew up on a commune in Connecticut. Yes, that is an alliteration. the characters there are, it's so diverse and so wonderful, and yet I'm very proud of my hometown, and I'm unlike Andy, who didn't really go home. He sort of settled in Manio, and I think it was that call of the last colony that got him hooked down there. I'm fortunate that I have a family farm to go back to, and I've re-entrenched myself in my hometown again, which I love.
Well, when you heard from anybody ever associated with that show, they will tell you, in a way, it was a reality show. They were really trying to, through script and with actors and with producers and directors, recreate a scene that everybody in America, oddly enough, whether they came from the South in a small town, somehow could relate to something in that show.
Oh, it's brilliant. It's morality plays. They use them to teach Bible classes. But I've been watching and watching and watching all the shows and studying it as I think about how structurally we can do some clever things in our artistic venture of telling the real Mayberry. But, yeah, very proud. I mean, Russell Hyatt, the barber who Floyd is named after, he's in the Barbershop Hall of Fame. The people there are really something.
You told me that the man who saved John Kennedy on PT 109.
It lives in a retirement home there, and down the hall, I think, from Thelma Lou or down the way. Or I had the great fortune of meeting Emmett, before he passed away, Andy's best friend. And what an incredibly, but he tells me stories that I never knew about how Floyd Pike traded on the New York Stock Exchange, really got started on the backs of money from some moonshining, who from the father of Donna Fargo, the famous country singer, whose dad was the biggest known moonshiner in the county.
Truth and reality are stranger than anything we've ever done on this show. My guest today, Bill Hayes, and our conversation will continue. We're going to talk to Bill about how he developed these hit series and what's on the storyboard. What's coming up on The State of Things? Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking with the founder of Figure Eight Films, Bill Hayes, creator of several documentaries and hit television series on the Learning Channel and Discovery Channel as well. I want to talk a little bit more about Mount Airy because, of course, every once in a while a still would play a part in that. And I think Otis owed most of his career, his drinking career, to distilleries. But you said the real Mount Airy was a kind of a dangerous place.
Yeah. I learned a lot about the history while I'm researching this project. They have a brilliant history museum on Main Street in Mount Airy, a regional museum. And so we interviewed the curator of that, and he starts telling me the story about, I never knew this, my hometown being like little Chicago back in the 40s and 50s and being a dangerous place because of the moonshine trafficking. I mean, there was an opera house on Main Street above my granddad's hardware store I didn't know, but, you know, the wonderful thing about what I get to do is when the deep drill is when you start learning these things that you never knew, and they're, like I said earlier, they're much better than you ever imagined.
And well, what's the difference between what we would call a reality TV show in terms of, I mean, I guess my question is, what do we get out of it? Why are they so popular? And, you know, you talked about being part of Full Frame, great documentaries that can't see the light of day, and they're terrific, terrific films.
Well, reality, if you want to call it that, or a docuseries, you know, it has the benefit of time. You know, the clock is ticking always, but the clock is really ticking when you're making a documentary, whether it's a half hour short or whether it's hour or whether it's a feature. So you've got X amount of time to tell a story, whereas the reality shows, we're really going along for the ride with somebody. I call it experiential, if you will, in its orientation more so. You're experiencing life through somebody else's set of eyes. So, you know, you just keep going and going with them because life keeps going on.
Well, that's interesting then, the serial nature of it. In other words, if I sit down and watch a fabulous documentary in a two-hour period, you know, and I want to tell you how cool Muscle Shoals was and what the music
scene
that.
Was. Love that. I saw that.
Fabulous film, and it's a great part of our history, great part of music history and a lot of ways in. But I saw it once. It was 2 hours. And I talked a lot about it the day after and a little bit the next day. And this is the first time I mentioned it in 2 weeks. But an ongoing series, we're always talking about it, aren't we? And it integrates itself into our lives.
Well, these shows have sort of, they've become part of our fabric, much as a sitcom became like a Seinfeld or a Sanford and Son or the Andy Griffith Show. They became something that we watched on a weekly basis. So they became part of the fabric of our life. And that's what these shows have become. We've become interested in, you know, trying to live life vicariously through other people's lives. We try to think of ourselves as, I'd call us, benign voyeurs, where, yeah, I'm a big fan of Charles Kuralt, always was. So when I started my own company, and still to this day, I try to think about how do we aspire to be that kind of storytellers, where he had such a great appreciation for the, I wouldn't call it quirky as much as, they were interesting people, idiosyncratic, but he, great appreciation. So, and, you know, that's why we do what we do, I think. We want to tell stories to help people understand each other in one way, shape, or form. It's whether you look different or you act different or you sound different. We're still a lot more similar than we are different, but we let all these externalities trip us up.
I wonder, though, if a constant diet of these kinds of programs, I mean, you talked earlier about we have about our ear for authenticity. We hear the emotion in people's voice and we track it and it's more meaningful to us. If we see enough reality shows where people have been coached enough and perhaps mildly scripted enough, does that become our reality and change our perception, change the way we know the truth from not?
Yes. It's just like anything in life. If you have too much of it, it's not a good thing. If you eat too many steaks, it's not good for you. If you have, you know, too much of anything is not a good thing. And reality is the same thing. We, you know, it's hard, but that's the problem with our world and our society. Once we get onto something, boy, it's hard to get us to turn around and stop it.
Would it work to do something like Charles Carroll did? I mean, interestingly enough, when there were one or two attempts to bring him to weekday, right? He had a Sunday morning program, and it seemed well suited for sitting back with the Times and your cup of coffee and watching Charlie kind of spread out that story. Weekdays didn't work. It was too fast. Things were going on, and Charlie had to leave and go back to Sundays.
Yeah, I got the story told to me by the founder of all of Discovery, John Hendricks. Basically, he was a big fan of Charles Carroll. He went to Walter Cronkite and said, let's do this. They tried an hour after the Carol Burnett show. It didn't work. So he said, well, I'm going to start a network. So he started the Discovery Channel. Because of Charles Carroll, there is the Discovery Network, if you really want to put two and two together.
Again, if you think about the way we tell stories, I'm going back now to what you said about your disillusionment having worked on a political campaign, the way messages are sculpted and we digest it and apparently accept it. And I'm thinking about the coverage we had and the very appropriate outpouring of grief that we all felt over Boston and the tension and drama of the chase and our desire to see justice done, all of that appropriate. And yet when we talk about a drone attack that our tax dollars have led to, the destruction of dozens of lives, innocent lives, in much the same way, we can't get the traction. We can't get that same kind of emotional outpouring for other human beings who may be Pakistani or Afghan. I mean, as somebody who deals in this kind of, we've got to make a story. What's going on there?
Repetition is one of the things that happens there. There was so much repetition with that story last week that we were just bombarded with it, and we couldn't get away from it. So we were forced to think about it. And I think through that repetition, we know is a very powerful ally for the advertising business, for the politics. We get the same message over and over again. There's something to that. It does work on our psyche. I think the Boston situation was so personal, though, because it could have, again, it gets back to that relatability. It could have been us. Could have been somebody we knew. It was. I called people I knew that were there. My wife's best friend was running in the race and had finished 10 minutes before. So it hit such a nerve that was so visceral. It was so close to us.
Yeah. But so that's interesting. So there are certain cultural touchstones, things that we really relate to, language, skin tone, dress. Those things are much more important than we might admit when it comes to our, say, our nominal connection with all humanity.
Oh, yeah. And even, you know, what's entertaining, you know, as we constantly look to landscapes for what's going to be the next appealing thing, you know, it's somebody so close yet so far away. Those Duck Dynasty guys, they've got that accent. They're, you know, a little crazy. So they've become wildly appealing to everybody, even the Honey Boo Boo. You know, wildly appealing because it's, you know, because you can relate. Even if it's not you, you know somebody like that or you've seen that. And then you become curious as to, well, what's their life like? And, you know, is it, you know, how much like or dislike mine is it?
What are the keys for you? When you were talking about your friends, because I'm sure people walk up to you all the time and say, Bill, this would be great. This would be great for you. And you have to. You know, one way or another, get out of that. But then you found one that you were a little surprised with.
It's character. You know, it used to be we look for topics. Now we look for characters. And I have some close friends up in Roanoke, Virginia, who have a fantastic salvage business, Black Dog Salvage. So I was fishing with them, trout fishing up in West Virginia, thanks to a mutual friend. And I went to see their place, and I was like, oh, my gosh, this is great. And they're like Mike Rowe, like Dirty Jobs. They're very relatable guys. They're the kind of guys you want to sit down, have a beer with, and hang out with. And they're very skilled because they will take these old barns apart or schoolhouses or whatever and then turn them into marvelous furniture, one-of-a-kind pieces for a good price that you couldn't find anywhere else. So we looked at the television landscape, saw Pawn Stars being a big hit, saw American Pickers being a hit. Said, let's try this. That we think we have something similar but different. And we call it the kissing cousin syndrome. If you've got something that's like, once we did John and Kate Plus Eight, then you saw a lot of similar shows, right? You know. So every time there's a hit on television, then you're going to see a whole nother wave of people trying to emulate that. But, you know, we try to figure out ways to not get too close to that and try to be creative ourselves and original.
So what's on the horizon now for Figure Eight Films? We didn't really talk about the evolution. How did you then create? Because you were doing the medical films.
Well, I was doing the medical films, and what happened was we created this dog series, Breed All About It, for Animal Planet, so I needed a new name. So I came up with Figure Eight Films because I liked the way the film strip works and what goes around comes around. Thought it, you know, it was a good name. It's not Figure Eight Islands. I do not own Figure Eight Islands, although some people accused me of that when we were doing the Kate Show. And then when we started doing more of the broad-based shows like the 19 Kids and Counting and the John and Kate, then it felt more like Figure Eight Films is a more appropriate name for those kinds of programs. And as we aspire to do broader types of programs, it felt like a natural fit for us. So that's how we came up with that. And then in terms of what we're looking at on the horizons, we've got a development team headed by Jen Stocks, who created the John and Kate structure. And she's got all kinds of really wonderful things. She's got cooking. I can't quite talk about all of them, but I'm working on a base series about minor league baseball with the help of Miles Wolf, who is the commissioner of a couple of independent leagues. And these are young guys in their 20s to 30s, double, triple A caliber ball players, but they want to get back and get into the show. So we're looking at that. The Real Mayberry, a docu-series, and also trying to create a web-based series with the young people of Mount Airy to tell their own story. So that's a different type of story for a different type of audience on a different platform, because we know that we've got to get into this Netflix web-based storytelling world quickly, as well as not just television. And then through Phil Campbell, who used to own the Flying Burrito, he brings fish up from these fish houses down into Harker's Island, where my wife Diane's got a house down there, and well, we have a house, I guess. And but I've been visiting the fish houses, which is just fabulous. So the hoitoiters, the hoitoid on the sonsoid tonight. You know, you've probably had Bland Simpson on this show before, but you know, Bland,
yeah, Walt Wolfram, who studies that kind of thing, yeah,
yeah. So you know, yeah, so I'm staying a little closer to home with some of these shows because, and people are asking me, saying, "Look, North Carolina is a big, diverse state. Why don't you try to find some more stories for us in your home state?" And I'm like, "I'm happy to, because I love my state."
How much does it change as you change platforms, web-based storytelling? Does the fundamentals change?
Structure. Yeah. You know, the story beats, as you could understand, hit differently in those kind of stories. You have the timing's different, shorter. You know, the kids want things that are shorter, and they want subjects that are pertinent to what they're interested in. But, you know, there's a great opportunity for telling stories for a whole nother generation with that generation.
Can you set out a challenge for yourself, like I'm going to go to a state and I'm going to get three stories from every county in this state, and that's going to, because they've got to be there somehow.
Well, I do have that challenge for myself. Mr. Friday, when he was alive, I used to meet with him and talk about this idea I've got called 100 Stories in 100 Counties. I think in every county in North Carolina, all 100, there's 100 stories. So one of the things of the future, when I'm not so doing this and that, is I want to try to empower the people of every county in North Carolina to tell their own stories. And then we've got the distribution means through the computers and the internet and the web to where we can share those stories now. And I think that we could build a stronger state through storytelling.
That's an interesting prospect, too, because on the one hand, there's a certain therapeutic value to being able to tell your story to someone who's listening. On the other hand, that story in its raw form might not be digestible. It might not be anything you're going to give to the public. Is there a place for that, and what's the value in that, do you think?
Well, you have to, again, like you said earlier, you have to work with people to tell their stories. I think that's where the beauty of the education comes in that it's one thing just to tell your story. It's another thing to tell it in such a way that it's palatable or absorbable by somebody else. So that requires time, energy, art, and some work.
And what about getting people to pay attention? Because it seems to me that if you start listening to or watching, if you prefer all those stories, you're going to get a broader sense of what our shared humanity might be like, the things that are important to people, apart from this kind of narrow vision if we keep seeing the same story told over and over and over again.
When I first started making television 20 years ago, this guy, Mike Quattrone, taught me something. He said, basically, get the viewer to go, wow, about every couple of minutes, and we'll have something here. And I've always tried to remember that. And I think no matter what kind of story you're telling on whatever platform you're telling to whomever, you want your viewer, your listener to go, wow, that's cool. Wow, I didn't know that. Wow, that's interesting. Wow, those people are crazy. There's lots of ways to get people to say wow. But if you got your audience to go wow every few minutes, then they're going to stick around for a few more minutes. It's the Valvano. It's like I'm also working on, I should mention, I'm working with Derek Wittenberg to do a documentary about his high school coach, Morgan Wooten, which is one of the greatest pleasures of my life, both working with Derek and getting to know Coach Wooten. But, back to which was his just film he just had on 30 for 30 on ESPN, which was Survive in Advance. Same thing with your viewers. You got to keep them. You know, otherwise, you get survive in advance. It's a platform for life.
Every word that's spoken needs to make you want to hear the next word.
Exactly.
I gotta need that next word. But so, do you prefer one over the? Do you prefer doing a documentary over series or series over documentary?
Oh, you know, I like everything. I'm this kid who, you know, I can't believe I get to do what I do. I'm the luckiest person on the planet.
Great stuff. What's your and I know you've been teaching. You're an adjunct professor as well.
Well, I've been farming lately. We've got a farm up in Mount Airy, and we have 16 acres west of Chapel Hill, which we're putting up a lot of fruit trees. So, in between trying to keep this TV thing going and creating new shows, I've usually got dirt in my fingernails.
You did love farming, see?
Yeah, what goes around comes around, I guess. Jesus.
When you teach, what's the central lesson? What's the big lesson for your students? What do you try to tell them?
I tell them what my mom taught me, which is my mom used to teach me to leave a place better than I found it. And so I've always tried. I said, that's a pretty good lesson in life. So I said, why don't you leave people better than you found them? I said, if you can leave a person better than you found it after you've worked with them, then you've done a good job. But they sort of look at me like I'm crazy because I'm like, look, if you want to do what I do, then you're going to have to, one, work hard, be smart, realize don't do it for the money, and realize that, you know, you've got an obligation to be truthful. And try to be excruciatingly honest even if it's difficult.
Bill, I think we are all the better for your visit. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bill Hayes, founder of Figure Eight Films, a production company based in Chapel Hill. He created and helped create such hits as John and Kate Plus 8 and 19 Kids and Counting. Go to WUNC.org for more information about him and his work. And this is The State of Things. Thanks for listening. We've got lots more at that website as well. So go to WUNC.org or stateofthings.org to find out more information about this show and the guests that were on it. Our program is directed by Alex Granados and produced by Isaac Davey Aronson, Sean Wen, and Nicole Campbell. Christina Blyde's our intern. Robin Copley's our technical director. Brent Wolf, the news director. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.